is Asia Insight, Asia Policy in a Pod.
My name is Michael Wills, Executive Vice President of NBR. Welcome to this episode of Asia Insight. The annual meetings of China's National People's Congress began in the Great Hall of the People in Beijing on March 4th, and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference began the following day. These meetings are called the Lianghui, the two sessions, because although they're technically separate, they always take place at the same time. The NPC, the National People's Congress, is the largest legislative body in the world, but it functions purely as a rubber stamp parliament for the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference is officially a patriotic united front organization of the Chinese people. Essentially, and it's an advisory body for the Communist Party. Last year's NPC, March 2023, the delegates voted overwhelmingly to award Xi Jinping a third five-year term as president of China, following his election the previous fall for a third and unprecedented third term as the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. Last year's meeting was also the one at which Li Qiang was named as the new premier. And this month's session in March 2024 was the first time that Premier Li presented his work report to the National People's Congress. And this unveiled the Communist Party's economic and policy goals for the year ahead. Interestingly, and in a departure from the practice over the past three decades since Deng Xiaoping initiated this process, Li is the first premier not to have undertaken a media briefing or press conference following the National People's Congress. And so what's been an already secretive process of trying to understand what's driving policy within Beijing has become even more difficult with one of those avenues that China watchers use to try and discern what's going on within the inner workings of the Communist Party. Today, I'm joined by my colleagues Nadege Roland, Distinguished Fellow for China Studies here at NBR, and Bill McCahill, a longtime member of NBR's Board of Advisors, to discuss the implications of the two sessions. Nadege's research at NBR focuses primarily on China's foreign and defense policy and grand strategy. She previously had a long career at the French Ministry of Defense. Bill has previously worked in both Hong Kong and China in international finance, prior to which he had a 25-year career in the Foreign Service, including diplomatic postings in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Beijing, and his diplomatic career finished with him serving as the chargé d'affaires at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing from 1996 to 2000. Bill, let's start with you. Xi Jinping in the past has used the two sessions as an opportunity to announce major policy declarations. What were some of the most important policies announced at this year's two sessions meetings, and were there any surprises?
Well, yes, I think there was a surprise, and I'll get to that, but start with what didn't happen. I mean, the vehicle for major policy pronouncements at these NPC plenary sessions is typically the premier of the State Council's government work report. Of course, it's not his report, he just reads it. It's a document that the Party Politburo has already signed off on, typically a week or more before the Congress begins. And this, as you mentioned, was Li Qiang's first appearance on this stage as the premier of the State Council. The government work report that he read was rather thin gruel, actually. It picked up a lot of the themes from last year's, which was report led by Li Keqiang, recently deceased, who was then still premier of the State Council. And for those, for foreign investors or foreign business people who were looking for signals of serious tackling of these kinds of interrelated problems that the Chinese economy faces, very high levels of public and private debt, the slow deflating of this tremendous property market, the kind of malaise you find among Chinese consumers. They're saving more than they're spending, and this may be a kind of long COVID in a sense, kind of in a way, one of the after effects of the zero COVID lockdowns and this sudden shift away from that. You've got rather demoralized cast of private entrepreneurs youth unemployment so high that the regime has even stopped publishing figures on it. On all of these issues, very complicated, certainly have the attention of foreign analysts and foreign business people, we really saw no substantive effort to tackle them. Little bits of things have drifted out in the on the margins of the NPC and afterwards a small program to try to deal with local government debt. A special bond issue to promote what Xi Jinping calls new productive forces in advanced industries like, well, not so advanced in some respects, but electric vehicles and their whole supply chains from batteries to finished products, solar power, sort of new energy stuff, AI, quantum computing, biotech, all of that kind of stuff. So there's roughly 100 million US dollars of government bond out there to stimulate those forces. And there was some hint from the State Council of a subsidy program to encourage consumers to replace their aged automobiles and household appliances and so on, but nothing really that really tackles these deep problems head on. What you did see, which came, I think, as in a sense a surprise, in a sense the kind of natural evolution of Xi Jinping's style of rule, was that the Congress passed revisions to the State Council organic law, which had the effect of folding the State Council, often called China's cabinet, the sort of group of ministries and the super ministry of the NDRC, the National Development and Reform Commission. These have now been folded ever more tightly into the party's central office, which of course is tightly under the control of Xi Jinping and his own immediate coterie of advisors. And as if to symbolize this kind of diminution of the State Council and its premiers, exactly the point you made in your introduction, Michael, that the Premier Li Qiang, breaking a tradition of 30 or more years, did not hold his after Congress press conference. So it's another kind of regression to the period before Deng Xiaoping set in train these reforms attempting to separate a bit the party from the state apparatus, a kind of separation of powers, if you will, in air quotes, that's really served China very, very well. If you think back to the optimum of period of this was the partnership between Zhu Rongji, who did the economy on the State Council side, and Jiang Zemin as general secretary, who did the politics.
I want to bring Nadezhda in a second. Thanks, Bill. But a quick follow-up question for you. China watchers often use the term the party state when we're talking about China, primarily to convey that this is not a typical government as we would understand it, with a separate executive and legislative branch.
Right.
What I'm understanding you saying with these revisions to the State Council, is that distinction valid any longer? I mean, is there still a party state, or is it just the party?
Well, I think the hyphen has disappeared. I mean, yes, I think party state is an accurate description to suggest that this really is not a government as we think of it. The premier of the State Council is not a prime minister in the sense of a parliamentary democracy. Xi Jinping is not a president in the sense that of someone. He's the general secretary of the party. And I mean, if you want to keep the hyphen between party and state, at the very least, capitalize party and keep state in lowercase. I mean, it's a very, very thin membrane, if any, that's there now.
Thanks. Nadezhda, let's pull you into the conversation here. I understand that the two sessions is largely focused on domestic issues for China, is an economic outlook. Xi Jinping over the last few years has talked pretty reliably and consistently about this daunting international security environment that's facing China. Bill has just laid out a long series of pretty daunting economic challenges that's facing the party. But let's keep the focus on the international landscape for a minute. Did you learn anything from this year's sessions about how China sees itself as a global power or its sort of foreign policy objectives?
The short answer to that is no, nothing new there either. Something that has been repeated is that the external environment appears to the Chinese government, whether it is party officials or state officials, which are usually the same one. I tend to call that the Pac-Man Party because it's that little thing that eats up all the state, bureaucracy little by little. It used to be distinct, and it's as Bill mentioned, it's less and less the case. The leadership seems to see the external environment as having adverse impact on China's economic development and vice versa. It's like the geopolitical conflicts are becoming more and more acute, and protectionism and unilateralism are on the rise. And so the work report doesn't mention anything new about how China is going to be outside or give any indication of change in its foreign policy. Li Qiang said that China is playing a constructive role in addressing some very hotspot crisis. Wang Yi also reminded the media that China had so-called helped facilitated the reconciliation between Saudi Arabia and Iran last year. But other than that, there's nothing there that says anything about foreign policy. Again, these meetings are more focused on domestic economic and social policy. And of course, because of the way that the party state thinks about these issues, how much economic and security issues are intertwined, and how much the domestic and international issues are intertwined, it's more and more difficult to dissociate the two domains. When we're thinking about the way the Chinese government is trying to tackle, or maybe not tackle, as Bill was saying, its economic issues. By basically boosting its manufacturing capacity and flooding the global markets, and with a lot of overcapacity, and in doing so, squeezing the space for overseas or foreign competitors and things like that, and creating trade frictions with both the US and the EU, you can see that even if those decisions are domestic, they immediately have an impact on China's foreign relations and with the outside world as well, and not necessarily in a positive way. These decisions are going to have a lot of negative implications for China's relations with the advanced industrial countries.
Thanks. Actually, before I bring you back in, Bill, let me follow down one of these doors that Nadezhda has opened here. You're describing these tensions that are going to continue to grow between China and the advanced economies, the US, the EU. Let's focus a little bit more in China's immediate neighborhood. We've got an interesting contrast. Just 2-3 months ago, the people on Taiwan elected democratically a new president. So cross-strait relations are sometimes an issue that comes up during these sessions. But what do you think the outlook for China's relations with its immediate neighbors in East Asia are, especially in the context of one of the things that Li Qiang did announce, which was a 7.2, I believe, percent increase in defense spending during the two sessions? I mean, China's talking about playing this constructive global role. It's had this decades-long period of rapidly growing defense spending to the point where it's now the second largest military spender behind the US. How should China's neighbors view this continued increase in defense spending, given the sorts of other tensions that exist on the economic and trade fronts?
This is it's interesting, as as foreign analysts to see that despite the economic slowdown and the problems that China is facing economically, there doesn't seem to have an impact on having a revising its military ambitions. So that tells you something about the priority given to security and in general, and the military part of it as well. So Xi Jinping didn't speak at the plenary sessions this year, but he had different meetings on the sidelines of the two sessions, including one with the PLA and People's Liberation Army and Armed Police representatives. And there too, he said, again, he sort of repeated things that he has said all along since he came to power, which is that the PLA, that the Chinese military needs to prepare for maritime military struggles and safeguarding its maritime rights and developing its military civil fusion. So again, I think we're really looking at a way when it's more and more difficult to disaggregate and to disassociate domains that, for example, we would think about as being completely different, like the economic innovation or the research and development on the one hand, and maybe the military modernization on the other. I think, and so the economic domain, the military domain, or the economic development and the security and stability of your country. I think these are much more integrated. And that, to me, this idea of continuing to push for an increased budget for the PLA is also a way maybe to foster more innovation and to have this civil military or dual use or fusion of parts of the technological innovation that's going to both serve military purposes and also the objectives that Xi Jinping has put forward to, those new or new productive forces or these sort of high tech, quantum. I don't know the list that Bill started to mention earlier that would sort of replace the real estate, but now it's like everything should be, semiconductors and batteries and green energy and things like that. So, but I think there's no, just like the membrane between the party and the state is less and less thick. I think the membrane between the general economy and the military development and military modernization is also thinning very much.
Thanks. I want to come back to Bill and look at the economy a little bit more. So you're both talking about this term, new productive forces. Bill, you mentioned the equivalent to, I believe, $100 million bond to spur innovation and production in some of those sectors. But thinking about that very daunting list of economic challenges that's facing the party right now, would that bond succeed in addressing some of the issues in terms of debt, property crisis? Is it the right solution?
I don't think it's a solution at all. I think it's an attempt to find a sort of panacea for problems that they, for one reason or another, I think there's a kind of policy paralysis, in fact, within the Chinese bureaucracy. But rather than face some of this other almost intractable problems head on and take the painful decisions that need to be taken, here's just more money to throw at something else. And it's a bit, as they say, as if this is going to be the panacea that cures all ills. It's also, I hear a little bit echoes of earlier Chinese attempts to have great leaps forward and so on. This kind of, we'll just vault over these endemic problems, almost all of them of the party's own making, by the way. I mean, why did they face this kind of demographic deficit? Well, 30 odd years of so-called family planning, and bingo, guess what happens? The labor force shrinks, the population ages, the fertility rate drops to around one now, and analogously, you've got 20 million or more unemployed kids, college graduates, so-called. Why? Because they're a bit this the sort of boomlet of people who came on in the night, but also the party in the late 90s vastly expanded the university system, tripling, quadrupling in some places, enrollments. And these schools will churn out graduates, often the very first in their families to have had a tertiary education, churn out people with academic credentials that are just not suitable to, they're just not fit for purpose in today's job. And at the same time, the regime has curtailed the growth of the so-called platform companies like Tencent and Alibaba, the for-profit education like New Oriental schools. 5 years ago, these were the darlings of foreign investors, and they created hundreds of thousands, if not millions of jobs, white-collar jobs for people with some kind of tertiary education. So they're just absolutely intractable, akin in many ways to the property dilemmas. I mean, here you have the property developers alone accounting for something like $2.5 trillion US dollars of debt. I think this is a Bloomberg number. And these local government financing vehicles, about four times that. So we're getting close to an aggregate number that's about the size of the Chinese GDP. And how do you deal with this? Well, the local government financing vehicles depended on auctioning land use rights to the real estate companies to fund their own deficits. So they're all in the red. Nobody's buying land anymore because they have more housing than they know what to do with. So there's just, it's a kind of, you peel back one layer of the onion and, you know, a stinkier one appears. Why don't you have a common sense property tax the way you have all over North America and to some extent in the UK and elsewhere? Well, everybody gives that lip service as they have for the last 20 years. But how do all of these local officials count for holdings of real property that they couldn't possibly have afforded on their salaries? So it's these problems, they've been festering and inbreeding in a way. And why don't we just find a kind of, say, a sort of panacea angel that we'll drop $100 million on this and see what happens, at the very same time that he's purging the senior generals in the procurement apparatus for corruption in handling the money they were already given. So it's, the general secretary, Emperor Levin, has a lot on his plate, and it's his plate.
Bill, I'm going to stay with you for a second. Two questions. The first would be just at the headline level, Li Qiang talked about the GDP growth target for China for 2024, around 5% in quotes. Now, you know, that was a little bit lower than the target for last year. There's obviously no post-COVID bounce on the cards for 2024 because we had that in 2023. Is there any realistic prospect that China hits something like that level of economic growth in the year ahead?
I don't think so. I mean, of course, the official figures when they come in soon after the turn of the year will show that they have. But no serious economic analyst of the Chinese economy believes that this is anything but fiction, really. And the key here is what you just mentioned, that there hasn't domestic consumption has really faltered. There is this kind of malaise among Chinese consumers, induced in many cases by the sort of whimsical whiplash of policies towards COVID, and then it's the sudden dropping of all of the in a way where the public health system, the pharmaceutical companies, and so on were unprepared. I think the consequences of that, this kind of shaking of consumer confidence in the regime's ability to manage the economy in a sensible way, I think that really has had a quite almost traumatic impact on a lot of people. And you add to that the fact that their household wealth was for the most part tied up in the property market, and they're watching that shrinking. Their kids might not be able to find jobs. I have friends with draft age sons who say in their private moments, forget about my kid joining the army and going to Taiwan. We're not going to do any of that stuff. So there's this whole middle class engine of growth that so many both Chinese and foreign companies had looked to as the next driver of the economy is really not there. That they can hit the numbers by throwing money at things, digging holes and filling them in, that sort of stuff, to be sure. But the model really seems to have it's kind of ground to a halt, and they don't seem to be able to find whether it's the intellectual sort of insight or the political gumption and will to solve it.
So,
but,
yeah, go ahead, Nadesh.
Yeah, if I can ask or add something about that, I wonder if it's a matter of not finding, you know, new ideas or finding, you know, the willingness to do it, or rather, like a very deep belief that those solutions would actually not serve the main purpose of the party, which is to sustain its own, you know, its own power. Because what everybody thinks is, you know, there's no way that this can't work. This is just patching, you know. These are not real solutions. It seems like they're digging themselves into a ditch. But I feel like in the list of options that the party state could have in front of his eyes, the things that would be necessary to get out of this ditch are also not acceptable for ideological reasons. Mm-hmm. It would be basically giving more power to the people, right? And liberating the private sector forces and making sure that actually the party doesn't control every corner or sector of the economy. And this is just not possible for a leadership that is just so obsessed with control and with absolutely no freedom, even in the economic space. So it's like it's a tricky. I don't know what you're thinking, Bill. If you agree or not, I'll be curious to.
I'm nodding vigorously in agreement. I mean, I think you've hit absolutely the bullseye of the target here, that any of these measures that would liberate the private sector would have the effect of eroding or weakening party control. And that is the one thing that they simply cannot tolerate. I mean, this is why you saw the squelching of Jack Ma and Pony Ma, that they had become forces in their own rights. And this was just intolerable, certainly as a sort of matter of, what would you say, protocol in a way, for the emperor himself was being overshadowed on the international stage by Jack Ma, who's going around hobnobbing on Wall Street and in Davos and so on in a way that the emperor can't possibly keep up with. This is lèse majesté of the worst sort. Mm. But the fact, if you start, as you've done, I think, Nadesh, from the regime's own sort of dark heart of hearts, that it's all about them staying in power, then these sorts of stimuli and the freedom of private entrepreneurs to grow simply cannot be tolerated. They're much better off just sticking with their own, what in business schools are called satisficing, just enough to get by without allowing for some of the creative spirits to surge.
And also the building of a welfare state is not possible either.
Exactly.
Because that would liberate the savings of the Chinese people, but this is also not an option, right?
I want to play this out a little bit, because you're describing to me a party that's so keen on controlling everything that the cost almost doesn't matter. But I'm remembering this period at the end of the pandemic where the continual lockdowns, and I can't remember whether it was the sort of extra month lockdown in Shanghai that prompted this, but the wave of protests that took me by surprise. And this was often, you know, Chinese people, everyday Chinese people coming out with blank sheets of paper and protesting by saying nothing because they knew they couldn't say anything. But that sort of months long, more than a year long sort of set of pandemic restrictions totally upended everyday life for people, finally drove enough to sort of the breaking point where they were willing to come out onto the streets and mark their displeasure with the regime. Even if, Bill, as you say, the headline numbers will hit the target that that Li Qiang set out in the two sessions, if China cannot or chooses not to resolve any of these economic crises to the point where the general population doesn't see a brighter future for themselves or their children, what's to prevent another outpouring of public dissatisfaction at some stage later this year or into next year?
Well, I think that's a possibility that very much is in the air. I mean, I just note that the blank paper protests as the COVID lockdowns really weighed on people were for the most part led by young Chinese women. And certainly when the regime went around rounding up ringleaders, it was the women that got put in jail. So there's a new productive force that they ought to be thinking about and that they are not. But I think the regime is confident enough in its own security apparatus and its surveillance capabilities. I mean, you've talked about the defense budget, and Nadezhda went on about the connection between domestic and international and the strategic defense affairs. She has succeeded in creating a kind of security state. And you see this not only the ubiquitous CCTV cameras and so on, and the use of facial recognition technologies, the use of the QR code on your mobile phone to get onto a train or an airplane, just absolutely across the board. And this, by the way, is sort of paralleled in the bureaucracy by the increasing prominence of the Ministry of State Security, which, despite the title, is really the party's sort of internal secret police, and the growth of this enormous cyberspace administration, promulgating rules on data sharing, on data transmission abroad, and so on. There are lots of ripples of this, you know, that the economic data that an investor would need to evaluate a company to invest in, these data have now become a national security secret. Well, how can you sort of entice foreign investors, as Xi Jinping did the other day in the Great Hall of the People with his, you know, this coterie of American business people, same guys he met in San Francisco 2 months ago, gave him the same speech, in fact. How can you do that on the one hand, when the very companies that look to do solid due diligence before making a big commitment of money in China, they get shut down and their staff's arrested? I mean, we're beginning to see, Nadezhda's last comment made it clear, that this sort of a kind of irreducible contradiction here between this political system and economic growth. I think we're not going to see regime change tomorrow, but there'll be lots and lots of very disgruntled people. Well, and so it's a factor the regime is going to have to account for in ways other than just exhorting people to suck it up and, you know, go work in the countryside the way Xi Jinping was supposed to have done as a 16-year-old.
Yeah, I'm actually wondering about that too, because it's like clearly increasingly politics supersedes the economic logic or demands and the security overtakes everything, the party security in particular. But I was also wondering whether, you know, you were talking about how would the Chinese people react to this new phase. And this is obviously very difficult to predict, but I'm just wondering also whether, you know, the past 30 years or 40 years with the increasing gap between the extremely wealthy in China and a very important part of the population that it really has been left behind that kind of economic development is also maybe, you know, in the same way that in advanced economies, the society is getting annoyed at the 1% who, you know, who are these people who live, you know, extravagantly and have access to everything and are extremely wealthy, and look at us who cannot have, who cannot finish the month or anything like that. It's really getting more and more difficult for us. So maybe the Chinese leadership's veering left in a way, being more, you know, being more like egalitarian and chopping up the heads of the most corrupt. I don't know. Is that, do you think that this is something that could be part of this, like, decision to have everybody on the same plane, but like on the lower side rather than the top one? You see what I mean? I don't know if this is a sort of
leveling down.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's certainly been there in the rhetoric, and you have Xi Jinping talking about common prosperity.
Right.
And then suggesting that Pony Ma would help meet that goal by donating $3 billion to some worthy cause. Well, that's getting at the 1%, all right. But what it doesn't tackle are the left behinds. You remember last year this time when Li Keqiang gave his last press conference and very pointedly let slip that there are 600 million Chinese people who are living on less than 1,000 renminbi a month. Mm. And that was the ceiling. And that's absolutely true. I mean, he drew on a very well-researched study from Peking University to show that. But of course, this gave the lie to something Xi Jinping had said repeatedly in the weeks before, namely that absolute poverty had been eliminated mm-hmm. in China. Mm-hmm. Well, that's nonsense. You know, I mean, I lived in China in the sort of the waning days of the immediate post Mao period, I guess, and knew what it was to have to use ration coupons to buy a cookie or a piece of clothing. It was a sort of poor fare state that they had created, which favored the urban areas, which were then only about 16% of the population, favored urban areas over the peasantry from whom the Chinese Communist Party in their own hagiography arose. So I think if Xi Jinping is turning the clock back on some of Deng's reforms to separate party and state a little bit, mm-hmm. he may also be turning the clock back to this earlier period of the People's Republic. And once people have seen the big cities, not sure they want to, you know, go back to the farm.
Can I take this just one step further? We're recording this at the end of March. One of the things that I've been watching in the news over the last few days has been this growing crisis around a company called Nongfu Spring, which is China's third largest soft drinks manufacturer.
Right.
And this is a crisis. It's different from the Tencent and Alibaba situations that you've been talking about. This is not a party-led attack on a yeah. company. This seems to be bottom up. This is sort of online nationalists trolling the CEO for being wealthy, for being insufficiently patriotic. And one of the allegations is that one of the labels on the soft drink was too close to a Japanese style imagery and therefore is not sufficiently Chinese. I'm still sort of trying to understand this point of tension between the party wanting to control everything and at the same time, this phenomenon we've seen for a number of years about a rising nationalism within China, especially online nationalism. Mm-hmm. And Is there a risk that that starts to kind of slip beyond the party's grasp? And I'm asking the question, mindful, Bill, of what you just said, because a lot of these trends do certainly evoke echoes of the late 50s and early 60s and some of the, you know, the prelude to the Cultural Revolution that we saw under Mao Zedong.
I guess the problem with nationalism is that the party has more and more used it in order to replace the older communist ideology, so it has been for the better part of 20 years now a tool that has both been used by the party to to manage some of its external relations, especially with Japan, for example, but also it has been able to damp it down very quickly, both by using its censorship tools in the past. But they're always going to walk a fine, dangerous line between letting those nationalists voices express themselves, which is, you know, the taking pride in China's achievements, but also there's also a xenophobic part that is expressing itself very much, and so that can veer into more criticism actually against the party for not doing enough in defending the motherland's interests or anything like that. So it's always a very it's always an instrument that is difficult to master.
It's really a genie that they've cultivated, and now it's out of the bottle, and very difficult for them to restrain it. And I'd also add, in the case you mentioned, Michael, of Nongfu, the Nongfu Spring, which, by the way, is not the purest. We're not talking about Evian water here, I should say. Some of this may well have come from its main commercial rival, whose founder and CEO had died not too long ago. This is Wahaha. The sort of rival bottled water, soft drink kind of company. The use of these nationalist tropes often turns up in commercial disputes, and these trolls are all for hire. So there might be some of that playing out here too. But I think Nadezhda's point is right, that you just, once you provoke these this sort of nationalist jingoist really sentiment, it's very, very hard to control and sort of harness it to the party's own ends. And just as they've been unable to staunch these occasional demonstrations of neo-Maoists on the university campuses and elsewhere, people who not only mouth the slogans about common prosperity and so on, but actually hold them up as a kind of mirror to the party. This is what Mao himself said, or Marx said, and why aren't we doing this? So I think for the moment, the security forces, the censors, are surely working overtime, and their numbers keep growing. But it really is a kind of ethereal genie that's out of the bottle and can go in all sorts of ways.
Well, we're almost at time here, so let's recap a little bit. Where it's my sense is you both agree that the most recent two sessions have been yet another example of Xi Jinping asserting his personal control, and I think, Nadezhda, you were the one who described the eroding of the membrane between the party and the state, so that the party is now much more firmly in control of more and more parts of the state apparatus. As you look ahead over the next month or two, briefly, Nadezhda first and then Bill, what do you anticipate happening post two sessions? I mean, what is the immediate outlook that you're sort of watching as a sign of either some of these negative trends that you've talked about showing themselves, or that, you know, maybe there are moves in a slightly different direction? But what are the things that you're watching out for as the indicators for where China's heading?
I wouldn't keep my hopes too high, actually, in the next few months with regard to the two sessions implications. As Bill mentioned in the beginning, it's becoming more and more a bureaucracy that is under the control of the party, and which basically says in so many words that it has to uphold and resolutely implement the party's decisions and guidelines. So there is nothing that the NPC or the CPPCC are going to be able to do by themselves. And as Bill also mentioned, these decisions were taken elsewhere in advance, and so they're just recording it and saying, okay, this is where we're going, so we need to implement what the real center of power has decided. So this is their mission now. So the main decisions are not taken by these two institutions. The decisions are taken inside of the Politburo and the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party. And these institutions are just going to move forward in just implementing those decisions. So there's not going to be any surprise.
So this is, Nadezhda's mention of the Central Committee reminds me to note that there has yet to be a third plenary session of this current the third plenum. Since 1978, when Deng Xiaoping used the third plenum of the then, I think it was the 11th Central Committee, to announce not only reform and opening of the economy, but simultaneously normalization of relations with the United States, the momentous event. And ever since then, these third plenary sessions have been used as kind of as the platform for announcing economic policies, typically those that move in a more market-oriented direction. So on that traditional calendar, the third plenum of this Central Committee should have met sometime last autumn. So we're already 3 or 4 months behind there. And is that because there's no consensus among the party's senior people? The Central Committee and its alternates are 300 and some people. It's all the, you know, it's big military people and the big SOE bosses and so on. Is there not enough consensus that Xi Jinping, as the general secretary, can convene this meeting and show that he has the support of the Central Committee behind whatever policy he does? So I think that's something to watch for over these coming months. Mm-hmm. On the side of sort of public opinion, such as it is, you know, the weather's getting warmer in China, and kids are going to get out of school, and construction workers who had jobs are unemployed. You know, will there be some rabble rousing in the streets? I think almost certainly. Will the regime move to clamp down on those, perhaps with quite severe force? Absolutely. Are there fewer foreign correspondents in China to record this? Of course. Yeah. But nonetheless, some of this is going to come out, and there'll be signs, I think, of social discontent that we should be alert to.
Well, thank you. Bill McCahill, Nadezhda Alon, thank you both for joining us for this episode of Asia Insight. And for our listeners, very much hope that you enjoyed this discussion. Please visit NBR's website at www.nbr.org for more of our work on China. Thank you.
Asia Insight. Asia Insight podcasts can be found on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, and Spotify. Thank you for listening to this episode of Asia Insight.